Wow, this is very exciting because this week I have actually traveled into the future, and I can't tell you which method I used. I can't tell you whether I slingshot around the sun. I can't tell you whether I spun the Earth backwards. I can't tell you whether I visited a guardian. But I'm talking with the historian of the future, David Goodman, who has written the history of the United Federation of Planets, the first 150 years.
That's the nerdiest opening for an interview I've ever heard. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 336, History of Federation. It's the second week of May 2013 as I record this, and the second Star Trek movie directed by J.J. Abrams opens this weekend, which makes this the perfect time to go back and look at a little Star Trek history. TV writer and self-described King of the Nerds David A. Goodman has written Federation, the First 150 Years, a faux history book written in the future, chronicling the history of Star Trek's United Federation of Planets, starting with Zefram Cochrane's development of warp drive in the middle of the 21st century. Now, many of you have probably already stopped listening, but my wife got me this book for Valentine's Day, and when I saw David in Los Angeles recently, I tried to explain in my highly articulate way my reaction when I first saw and then read the book. It's I had such a nerd boner, such a nerdgasm on every page, because what you've, well, you t- here's what I
well,
think
it's
you
It's interesting because most nerds don't get presents on Valentine's Day from women.
It's true.
So that was you were really set apart in that way.
And they wouldn't know what to do with boners if they had them, but tell me what the book is.
The book is a sort of faux history of the Federation. The concept being that this book was written as a 150 years after the founding of the Federation as a sort of historical document. And we look back from 150 years from the beginning of the Federation to how the Federation came to be. And the idea of it was to take those little bits of history that had been mentioned in all the Star Trek TV shows and movies and string them together and fill in the blank spots and make a cogent historical quote, nonfiction, unquote, book. Make it read like it's nonfiction.
It absolutely does. And I have no idea how it reads to a person who doesn't know anything about Star Trek. Is there any market research on that?
The only evidence I have is my book editor, who I had to tell her, give her a list of a few Star Trek episodes to watch so that she wouldn't be completely in the dark. But in general, she didn't have nearly, obviously, the knowledge of even the most basic Star Trek fan. Mm-hmm. And she read it and seemed to like it. So that's the only person I know who is not a Star Trek fan who read it.
It's a cool idea. One of the things I loved so much about the book is that, yes, it touches on many aspects of Star Trek lore that I know from having watched the original series and The Next Generation pretty religiously, and then watching Deep Space Nine sporadically, Voyager not so much, and Enterprise a little. Right. And yet the book highlights so many of those familiar parts, but also so many of these parts that made me want to go back and watch these episodes, some episodes again, because you're touching on episodes that I had forgotten about and bits of Star Trek lore that are more important than I thought they were.
Right. Well, I mean, that's sort of the whole thing of the book, is that when I approached it was the idea that it turns out some of the worst episodes of all the series are the ones that dealt with Federation history. So you know, dealing with some. So I suddenly was writing longer pieces of the book about and trying to make interesting episodes that I actually didn't find that interesting, and then also trying to fix. You know, it's very interesting. Like. I'm a television writer by trade, mostly, and so I understand how the original Star Trek was written. It was written by freelance writers who would come in, they'd pitch their ideas to Gene Roddenberry or to the story editor Gene Kuhn or Dorothy Fontana, and they would pitch their ideas, and their ideas would get sold, and then that writer would go off and write their script and bring it back, and then the script would be rewritten. But there are all sorts of things that nobody was really paying attention to sort of back then, to this idea that this show would still be, anybody would be talking about 50 right. years from now, let alone a phenomenon, let alone a cultural icon.
Yeah.
And so there are things that dealt with the history of the Federation that make no sense at all.
What? What? Stop blowing my mind.
Because this freelance writer was like selling a script and paying
right.
his rent.
Right.
And
right.
he was like throwing in something he thought was interesting, but whether you look at it for 5 seconds, it makes no sense at all. And so there was a lot of that, trying to make sense of things, make it sound like it all was planned out. It was all lays out, and it's all very naturally unfolding story.
Well, there's two things about that. One is that I always laughed at the people who didn't like Lost because they're just making it up as they go along. Really? Of course they are.
That's right.
Of course they are. But also, the other side of that thing that I think is so cool is that the history that you're writing is in large part made up by TV writers who were just trying to pay their rent. And suddenly the ideas they come up with become part of established Star Trek lore.
Right. And to just sort of give them their due, you know, the fact was, I think one of the reasons that Star Trek lasts is that there was care taken when that show was being produced. Some things fell through the cracks, but in general, the shepherds of that show, whether it be Gene Roddenberry or the writers who worked for him,
right.
they were caring about like consistency. They were caring about continuity. They
right.
were caring. They missed some things. Things fell through, but
that's inevitable. That happens.
But they cared about it, so they were creating this. There's a great book. There's a great essay in a book by Michael.
Okuda?
No, Chabon. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Chabon? Oh, Chabon, Michael Chabon.
Chabon, whatever.
Guy.
Called on fandom Sherlock Holmes. It's a book of essays, and he talks about how Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, left a lot of things blank, but he had a tapestry of history, mm-hmm. and that fans since then have tried to fill in those blanks.
Right.
And Star Trek, you know, is a great example of that
yes.
because that they left blanks. They left blank spaces, and that's what this book does. It tries to fill in the blanks, but I'm not the first person to try to do this.
Well, left blank places, but also created a world and characters
right.
in which so many people wanted to jump in and be part of that world.
And also created this backstory
yeah.
that somehow lived and somehow was consistent and didn't throw it out with every episode.
Right.
Said, no, wait a minute, we said this in this episode, so let's be consistent. And, you know, or we mentioned the Klingons in this way in this episode, and
right.
let's be consistent.
Well, and as you say, you're a TV writer by trade, but you're not just some chimp off the street either. You have...
Thank you.
You are really some chimp off the street. But you wrote on Enterprise...
I did.
But you also have done many Star Trek-related episodes in the other shows you've worked on, Futurama and Family Guy specifically, right?
Well, you know, that is just a fun... Yes. So that is a function, though, of... wherever I happen to be, there are other Star Trek fans, and they're like, "Oh, wait, let's get David to do it because he's the biggest one." So,
but everybody says we need to do a Star Trek episode. Let's have David do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's essentially what happens.
So, I loved your Star Trek Golden Girls episode.
Oh, thank you. No, we didn't. Yeah, but I think there are Star Trek references in Golden Girls, although they were not mine. But it shows up in like. Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane's a huge Star Trek fan. It's one of the reasons I got hired
right.
was because in a job interview, the guy who was interviewing me with Seth said, "Oh, you know, David's a big Star Trek fan," and I think that was why I got the job.
And did you get him the job on Enterprise?
I did. I was on Enterprise, and that was when Family Guy was off the air for the 3 years. It was Seth was in the wilderness,
mm-hmm.
and we were very friendly. And he was a big Star Trek fan, and turns out the guys who created Enterprise. Were fans of Family Guy, you know, at the time it was not the big show it would become.
Right.
And so I pitched them, let's give Seth a part, and they were like, absolutely. And Seth played a sort of an unnamed engineer in one episode and then became an engineer by name in another. The same engineer continued. And I believe that character is in my book.
as an important enough character to warrant mention in the history of the Federation.
I think he dies in the book.
Spoilers.
I think. I Ensign Rivers is, I believe, his name, and I'm fairly certain I mentioned him, and I'm fairly certain the ship he was on may have gotten destroyed.
Hi, this is Scott Bakula, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Okay, can you please take the gun away from my head now?
Where can you RSC the RSC? In June of 2013, you can see us in Columbia, Maryland, in the U.S. And in the U.K. in May, June, and July, you can see us in Crawley, Tunbridge Wells, Tewksbury, Bromsgrove, Newtown, Bridport, Barnstable, Solihull, Hereford, Harlech, Great Yarmouth, High Wycombe, Camberley, Surrey, Hastings, East Dulwich, Aberystwyth, Southport, Lincoln, Barnsley, Barrow, Inverness, Leeds, Ayr, Stirling, South Shields, Musselburgh, and London for 4 weeks at the Leicester Square Theatre in July and August. Now, several of these performances are already sold out, and many of them are close to it. We've also just added more UK touring dates this fall of 2013, and very soon we'll be adding more international and US dates, so check those out as well. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. Now, David Goodman's book, Federation, the First 150 Years, is currently only available at Amazon, and it comes presented on a unique Federation pedestal. And when you press the button marked Initiate, you are greeted by this very familiar voice.
Hello, this is Admiral Hikaru Sulu, Commander-in-Chief of Starfleet Command, welcoming you to Memory Alpha. I am proud to present this history of the Federation, commissioned by the Council of the United Federation of Planets on the 150th anniversary of its incorporation.
And how did the book come to be? Did you approach a publisher? Did they come to you? How did that all work?
It was a very weird thing, because it was the kind of thing where I got a call from a friend of mine who I'd worked with on Enterprise, who worked at Paramount, and he was connected to CBS, which Paramount and CBS are obviously separate companies, but they share Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And he had heard about this project, and they were looking for a TV writer, because the thing about this book was they wanted – the book isn't just the history. It's also these snippets of historical documents. So they wanted a writer who had some comfort in writing in different voices, right, which is certainly the TV writer's job. So they wanted a TV writer, and preferably somebody who'd written for one of the Star Treks.
Right.
And Dave Rossi, who I think in the book was the guy who thought of me, and it was really this kind of thing where – they called me, and then I met with CBS Consumer Products about it. And I honestly, I can't believe they want to do this book. I want this book. Not that I wanted to write it. I wanted the book.
You wanted to read it.
Yeah, I just wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
And because there was a book when I was younger called The Starfleet Spaceflight Chronology, which was kind of a weird cousin of this book, uh-huh, which tried to fill in Federation history. And I was always a big fan of it. It had a lot of great art in it. And so the fact that they were coming to me and they were asking me if I wanted to do it, and I honestly kept expecting somebody to say, have you ever written a book before? Because I never had. I really thought as soon as they asked that question, I'm done. I don't know how to write a book. And they never did. And finally, I asked it. You guys know I haven't written a book, right? And so there was, you know, it was this. I was very lucky. It pays to be nice to people. I mean, Dave is a friend of mine, mm-hmm, and the fact that he thought of me was great. And then it ended up just being this great project. I didn't have very long to write it, and I was also running a television show at the time, so it was a little hectic. My wife, that's a Freudian slip. My wife was not very happy about the project, but in general, now it's all good. So
I remember her complaining to my wife about it for a short period. So it was challenging and a kind of a dream come true, in a weird way, a dream you never knew you kind of had.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that this is the kind of thing that fans love to do. I think that you're filling in the blanks. My favorite part of the book is the Romulan War, which is something that was mentioned in the original series and something we were kind of leading up to when I was working on Enterprise, but not in any specific way. We didn't decide, let's lead up to the Romulan War, but we started dropping hints and so I got to write that. And that was actually one of the biggest things I was excited to write, because it was something of like, I'm a history buff, so I read a lot of World War II history, and so I folded a lot of that in. Right. And there was all this kind of stuff that I was like, I get to do this, yeah. And that was definitely exciting.
Well, and I mean, just reading it, there were so many great throwaways, but for one, I loved just the way you dealt with the fact that when Zefram Cochran first appeared, he looked like one actor. And then despite the fact that he was in his 30s, he looked like James Cromwell, the actor from Babe in the movie, and you kind of explained that away. And that was a fun part of the history for me.
And I spent a lot of time on that. I've spent a lot of time on, you know, that there wasn't any solid deciding in the movies exactly when he was born, but there are things that were said in novelization, and there are all these things where, like, I want to be true to the people who've been paying attention to this stuff.
Yes.
And so it was sort of, that was sort of the challenge of, like, the book was for me. I mean, that's so interesting about it is I really did want this book for myself to read it, not to just to write it. So anything that I wrote, I was very conscious of, well, what would bug me if the writer didn't pay attention? What detail would it bug me if the writer didn't pay attention to? And so there was a lot of, that was the biggest part of the work, was making it good enough for me to buy.
Did it feel a little bit like you were having an opportunity to get some things right, like some things you did in Enterprise that maybe we didn't kind of get as appropriately as well as we could have gotten?
Well, I didn't want to change anything, and I didn't want to change anything that had been said. But there definitely was sort of an attempt to make sense of some things that, let's say, well, there was stuff on Enterprise where we really just didn't do enough work making it make sense. So.
But also, the job of Enterprise, the writers of Enterprise, was not to write the history of the Federation either, you know? So,
no, it wasn't. But there was a way in which it's like, because it took place as a prequel, because you knew the Federation was coming, we probably did have a bigger responsibility to sort of set up the Federation. And we may have missed the boat on some things that we shouldn't have. I enjoyed working on Enterprise, and I thought we did some great stuff, but there's definitely the things we didn't pay enough attention to. We did this whole season about the Zindi, and we did not spend enough time figuring out a cogent backstory for those people. And so I had to figure that out in a way and write that in a way that didn't disagree with anything that had been done, but in some way made it sort of cogent. And so that was tough. It was tough.
Well, and the whole aspect of the fact that the Klingons look one way on the original series and they look different, I love the explanations that have been put forth about why that is, but you decided not to deal with that.
And that, for me, was a decision that affected a lot of things in the book, which was, how the Klingons look is not important to the history of the Federation. Like, this is a history book.
Right.
So how Klingons looked, who the Klingons were mattered, and how they affected Federation history mattered, but how they looked really didn't matter. And I didn't like the explanation we had in Enterprise. So, so that was the other piece of it, too. It was like, I can either embrace it, and since I didn't have to embrace it, I would have to have embraced it. I would never have dismissed what had been written in the TV show.
Right.
But since I didn't have to for this book, I decided, you know what? This is the history of the Federation. The Klingons affected the Federation, but how they looked didn't affect the Federation.
Right, I see. I guess how the Klingons look will be the subject of another book, maybe? is there a sequel? It will be the second 150 years coming out at all?
Well, you know, it depends on the sales of this book. I mean, this book, it doesn't cover the Next Generation years, and those are much difficult years to cover because you have three television series, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, and Next Generation, that cover that period.
Right.
And so you have to cover so much stuff because they were dropping hints, and you're now covering. I covered things that were mentioned in Next Generation and Deep Space Nine that affected the first 150 years, but now you're talking about the next 150 years. It's a much more dense, it would be a much harder job for me to sort of go through all those episodes and make it make sense, make sure that that history makes sense. And but if they ask me, I'll say yes. I mean, that's the...
Well, and do you only focus on the TV shows and the movies? You don't have to go back and read all the novels. God, no, you couldn't.
I couldn't, and I didn't. And, you know, I've read some, and there's some sort of little homages to things that I liked in certain books in there. But no, I mean, for me, Star Trek is television. I mean, it's movies now too, I guess, but it's television.
Yeah.
And to me, as a watcher, it's like, and a reader of the associated material, like books and this kind of thing, or websites, you're only looking at that stuff to sort of fill in the time that you don't have TV episodes to watch.
Right.
So that's how I look at this book. Like, this is a book for people who watch Star Trek on television or in the movie theater. But it's even the ones, even those movies don't come out often enough. It's the TV episodes. It's the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of TV episodes. So it's like this book is for somebody who's watching those TV episodes and wants to pick it up. And it's like, oh, look what he did here, and he's filling it in. And you know that not everybody's read every book. Not every fan's read every book. Right. Not every fan's read every magazine. So,
so you've been a Star Trek fan forever, mm-hmm. and you actually now and have worked in television for many, many years. Yeah. I know you've met a bunch of the original cast members. What's been the coolest part of meeting the original crew of the Enterprise?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, there's different stories. I mean, I think probably the one of my favorite stories is we recorded our Futurama episode, which reunited everybody. My original title for the episode was "We Got Everybody But Scotty," because we got everybody but Scotty. DeForest Kelly was dead by that point, but everybody else who was alive came to the show, and we recorded William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy together. And Leonard Nimoy came in first. He was recording some lines without Shatner, and he came in, recorded his lines, and then we took a break, waiting for William Shatner to show up. And so I go to the bathroom. And I'm at the urinal, and Leonard Nimoy steps in next to me at the urinal next to me. I'm trying not to laugh. But I'm pretty sure that he was peeing as Spock. I think he was still in character. He's very kind of wow. cold. But, you know, so
that's how good a nerd you are. You can tell whether he's peeing in Vulcan or whether he's...
I think, no. But so that was like, honestly, I'm just like, he has no idea who he's peeing next to. He just thinks it's some guy who works on the show. And it's like one of the biggest Star Trek fans who's ever lived. And I'm getting to pee next to Leonard Nimoy. But, you know, I have worked with George Takei and Nichelle Nichols. I actually did a TV movie with Nichelle a long time ago, and they're always so friendly. George Takei came in and recorded this thing for this pedestal and was so just gracious. You know, they're very nice people. They're all really nice people. Shatner, when he came in to record Futurama, was, you know, he didn't want to do the Khan. We had him say Khan, and he really didn't want to do it, but he did it.
He's a pro.
He did it. You know, we did a whole thing on that show where the actors have to read this bad script, this bad fan script, and he and I and the acting. We said they should act it badly, and he bristled at that. It's like they would be trying to do it as well as they could do it.
Right.
And I thought that was like,
right.
All right, well, this is interesting. Yeah. but you know, so I've had these little snippets of interactions with them over the years, and very nice people, and that's obviously a very, very cool thing.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your fan scripts via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans on our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a Twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Red Shirt Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band, and also this week by Michael Giacchino and, of course, Alexander Courage. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Bearded Ian. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Captain Scott Bakula, and thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 336 1,008ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. I'm just glad that you were willing to take the time to talk about it, because I feel cool by proxy.
Yeah. No, nobody thinks we're cool talking about this book, Austin.
What? No!
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.